This is Steve Densley Jr., and this is the Mormon Faircast. This episode of the Mormon Faircast features an open letter to Dr. Michael Coe by Dr. John L. Sorensen. In August 2011, John DeLynn conducted a three-part interview with famed Mesoamericanist Michael Coe. DeLynn operates the podcast series Mormon Stories, which features interviews discussing the faith and culture of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. However, Mormon Stories has a bias that is ultimately hostile to the truth of the Book of Mormon. It is slightly more surprising that it makes this ideological bias so clear throughout the interview with Coe. For example, DeLynn tells Coe and his audience, "This is a tough thing for believing Mormons to hear, but I think it's important if we are going to live in a world of reality, if we are going to benefit from all that science has provided us. I don't think that we as Mormons can just conveniently dismiss what science and history and linguistics and anthropology and archaeology and genetics all tell us about the Book of Mormon." Thus, the interview with Coe is intended to demonstrate that those who believe in the Book of Mormon as an ancient text are not living in a world of reality, since doing so requires either ignorance or rejection of vast amounts of scientific data. This is done not out of any animus, we are repeatedly assured, but only out of a tough love need to speak the truth. Dr. John Sorensen, an emeritus professor of anthropology at Brigham Young University and author of numerous publications on the Book of Mormon, was asked what he thought of DeLynn's interview and Coe's characterization of the scientific data. Sorensen provided the following open letter to Coe. Listeners to the Mormon Faircast can also look forward to Sorensen's promised volume, Mormon's Codex, which will cap a lifetime of research on the subject. If nothing else, the interview with Coe demonstrates once again how little focused attention non-LDS scholars and critics, and even some cultural Mormons, have given the Book of Mormon or the work of serious scholars in its exploration. This is perhaps because most are firmly convinced that they know the answers before they begin. And now, an open letter to Dr. Michael Coe by Dr. John L. Sorensen, read by Alan Wyatt.
Dear Mike, some people see a placid stream ahead of them and think the water must be safe to cross, only to find that their depth perception was faulty and deep holes await them. Something like that has happened to you in regard to your podcast with Mr. DeLynn about the Book of Mormon. Before you and other readers repeat the difficulties you encountered, I venture to offer some corrections. I will start with the archaeology. In that regard, you said, "These things don't disappear forever. They leave traces. If you had iron or steel, you would expect to find these things even if they were all rusted. You'd find chemical remains. It is interesting to see your loyalty to the ideals of archaeology, but surely you know that the realities are quite different. The first place where the two collide is in sampling. Probably no more than 200 ancient Mesoamerican sites have been seriously excavated, and those excavations have rarely dug into more than a small portion of the inhabited area of those sites. It would be surprising if as much as 1/10,000th of the information potentially available by studying the material remains has so far been disclosed. Sure, much of the rest would no doubt yield data mainly duplicative of what is already known, but some would not, and a large proportion of what has already been excavated has not been studied by contemporary methods or is not accessible for study. So ancient remains of metals may leave traces, but can anybody name even a single site where chemical remains have been widely sought by modern methods? I doubt it. An example of the sampling problem is evident at the site of Utatlan in Guatemala. Fox, Wallace, and Brown reported finding, by chance, a location just outside the site proper where 200 molds for the manufacture of copper at an industrial level came to light. The facility would have been far larger than what was needed for the city's requirements. What is the chance that such an isolated facility outside the central ceremonial centers where excavation usually goes on would ever be discovered at other places? Then there is the problem of accessing the information that does exist. I have spent considerable time searching site reports for mentions of metal objects that have been found that apparently date before the metal curtain of about AD 900 in Mesoamerica in the area, but are conveniently ignored in discussions of the history of metallurgy. There have proved to be several hundred such specimens dating from 400 BC to AD 900, 153 of which were excavated by professional archaeologists. Why bother to seek chemical traces of metal when actual specimens are totally ignored? This incidence of metal objects would be even more surprising were it not for the fact that terms have been reconstructed in five major Mesoamerican language families that mean metal or metal bell, all the words that thought to refer to times prior to 1000 BC. Obviously, excavational archaeology still has a long way to go in reconstructing a complete history of Mesoamerican metallurgy, including both terrestrial and meteoric iron among more than a dozen known metals and alloys. Eminent metallurgical expert Dudley Easby commented regarding this history, "The relative apparent absence of metals in the early Americas constitutes one of the most infuriatingly enigmatic subjects in the history of technology." The question of the presence of the horse in civilized Mesoamerica further illustrates the problem of what is adequate in archaeological sampling and documentation. C. E. Ray's report of finding horse bones in deep layers of the waterhole at Mayapan in the Yucatan raised anew an issue that Mercer and Hatt had earlier noted with their finds of horse bones in Yucatan caves. The matter was compounded by Peter Schmidt's 1988 work in Lolton Cave that found horse bones scattered throughout a number of layers of early pottery-bearing debris. He observed, "Something went on here that is still difficult to explain." Interestingly, he was not aware of Ray's finds. There are also further evidences for pre-AD 1500 dates of other horse bones, including three radiocarbon-dated finds from North America. This, like the metals, is an unfinished archaeological story, in this case defying the dictum that there were no horses for the last 10,000 years in America. Simultaneously, it shows the limits of the data revealed by excavations about which so much is said. Another possibility is that some other species were counted as a horse. For example, upon seeing Spanish horses, the Aztecs referred to them as the deer that people ride, and there are artistic representations of riders on deer. So what is a horse? Now, let's turn to the Book of Mormon itself. You said that the Jaredites didn't really survive terribly long, and that the Jaredites go back, what, something like 400-500 BC? However, the Jaredites left Mesopotamia at the time of the Great Tower, presumed to have been around the time of the earliest ziggurat, perhaps a little before 2500 BC. Their demise as a functioning society was after 600 BC. You also said that the Nephites were highly civilized people. In origin, yes, except that their small initial party, fewer than 35 men, women, and children, slogged 1,200 miles through the rugged mountains of Western Arabia over an 8-year period and subsisted mainly on uncooked meat. This would take most of the civilization out of anyone. When they embarked from the coast of Oman on a voyage of more than 20,000 miles, they took no animals with them and little technology except what knowledge they carried in their heads. Upon landing, Lehi's crew must have been about as deculturated as a frazzled band of people could be. You remark that in the Book of Mormon, they had cattle, they had horses, they had wheat. You also said that maize, by the way, isn't really mentioned in the Book of Mormon. However, refer to the above regarding horses. Also, immediately after landing, probably in coastal Guatemala, Lehi's people did find beasts in the forest, according to the text of the Book of Mormon, including cow, ox, ass, horse, goat, and wild goat. At length, some of these creatures ended up domesticated by means and hands not described. Clearly, the animals consisted of Native American species to which the newcomers, by a process familiar to groups encountering exotic fauna, applied nearest look-alike names to the newly encountered critters. The first mention of grain cultivation occurred nearly 400 years later. Corn, or maize, contrary to your claim, wheat, and barley. Corn was the grain of choice. What crop the name wheat was given to is never clarified, but of course it probably would have been some native one. Eventually, Mesoamericans cultivated at least 13 species of grains. Domesticated barley was discovered in archaeological sites in Arizona and Midwestern states 25 years ago, and it could well have grown in Mexico, too. You also said that they had the compass to navigate by, but this is not true at all. What they had was a device that gave Lehi's original party travel instructions, but it worked by faith, not on any mechanical principle, as a compass would. John DeLynn said, "There are steel swords mentioned in the Book of Mormon, or shields, or helmets, or whatever." And you responded by saying, "Yes, that's correct." However, Lehi's party carried with them on their trek a sword of steel that was preserved as a sacred relic. When Nephites and Lamanites by the thousands were armed with swords, they obviously could not have been of metal, nor is there any reason from the text to suppose that they were. At one point, a large group of Lamanites fled from military service by going to the place of arms to defend themselves. The description of the situation makes it appear to be an obsidian outcrop, possibly El Sheol. Their swords were very probably the obsidian-edged weapons called Macu Ahutul by the Aztecs. However, at one point in Jaredite history, the record says that they made swords of steel. This is clearly an unexplained anomaly. However, note that the term that is read steel in the King James Bible is currently translated by experts as bronze. A large variety of shields is known to have been used in Mesoamerican warriors from pre-classic times onwards, but helmets are not mentioned at all in the Book of Mormon. You further stated that wheeled toys are known in classic times in Veracruz, but actually, these begin, at Teotihuacan at least, immediately after the time of Christ, not just in the classic. Then you say, "Let's do the coins. If they were coins, they would be chocolate beans. Why aren't chocolate beans mentioned in the Book of Mormon?" However, years ago, the word coinage was gratuitously inserted in the heading of Alma chapter 11 by LDS editors. It has since been removed. There is no use of the term coins in the text. The Nephites used money, but evidently Nephite money, like that in the Israelite homeland, the shekel, was in weight-determined units of some valued substance. Cocoa beans were in use, how early we do not know, among the Maya, but throughout Mesoamerica a variety of other materials also served as money. The constant fallback on Maya culture is understandable in the podcast in terms of your archaeological background, but Nephite culture was not closely congruent with Maya culture. You also remarked, "Silk? Nothing." But the Spaniards described at least 5 Mesoamerican varieties of what they termed silk, or its equivalent. None of them used the species of silkworm that prevailed in East Asia. And you said that 7-day calendar was unknown in Mesoamerica. However, Helen Neuenschwander agreed with Eric Thompson that there was a 7-day week feature, one based on a logical division, 1/4 of a 28-day lunar month. In any case, the 3 mentions in the Book of Mormon of week do not say that the period was 7 days. Weeks of other lengths are known in various cultures around the world. Chariots, you asked? Mesoamericans never had chariots. Well, this may be correct. The meaning of chariots mentioned in the Book of Mormon text remains mysterious. They are mentioned only on 2 occasions, in very limited geographical areas, in connection with horses. And, by the way, no chariot has ever been excavated in Palestine, despite documentary statements implying that they were very numerous. Pig, you asked? 0, you said. Not one pig bone is ever shown in pre-Columbian excavations. But come now. Pecaries were hunted, kept, and even herded, and they surely are pigs. With regard to elephants, you said, there's nothing, absolutely 0. The Clovis people about 10,000 BC killed them all. But this is a good instance of converting Paul Martin's hypothesis into fact without checking the data. Mastodon remains have been dated by radiocarbon to around 5,000 BC in Florida, around the Great Lakes to 4,000 BC, in the Mississippi Valley to nearly 3,300 BC, perhaps to near 100 BC, near St. Petersburg, Florida, and at sites in Alaska and Utah dating around 5000 BC. In the Book of Mormon, mention of elephants occurs in a single verse in the Jaredite account, dated in the 3rd millennium BC, after which the record is silent, perhaps indicating spot extinction. You also said that every time you look at the illustrations in the popular edition of the Book of Mormon, you see that's a Maya city. But what do popular illustrations have to do with actual history? And even then, how would you know that the illustrator had in mind a Maya city instead of a merely Mesoamerican city? There is too much gratuitous Mayanization going on throughout this entire discussion. The text's Nephites were not Maya in all probability. The Lamanites may have been in part. You commented that there are no King Benjamins or anybody like that in Maya literature, but this is fallacious thinking. Would you say there are no Jesus Christ or anybody like that in Roman or Greek, Egyptian, Syrian, Jewish, etc. monuments or literature? Would you expect there to be? This has no relevance to the question of whether there was a Jesus Christ. Furthermore, history was often rewritten by successors. As Nigel Davies noted, I am more than ever convinced the codices were destroyed at intervals and history was then rewritten to suit the ruler of the day. Along the same lines, you said that when we start getting extensive Maya inscriptions, they don't mention any of these wonderful people out of the Book of Mormon. Nothing. In response to this, see the point immediately above. But how do you know the Nephites are not mentioned? Mention is a matter of using a name or ethnic label. But what name would the Maya use if they had referred to the Nephites? Surely not the English translation, Nephites. Of course, we do not know the native name in any language that the Nephites bore. You stated that there is no writing for the Olmec, which is peculiar if these people came from the Middle East. However, this is not quite correct. The Cascajal block is joined by the tread-upon figure at San Jose Magote and the item reported by Rust et al. From near San Lorenzo. All are dated to the Olmec era. Mike, in 2006, you co-authored a paper on the Cascajal block in Science magazine, describing it as the oldest writing in the New World. Your discussion and description seem confused because you tell DeLynn that this block contains Olmec writing dating to 900 to 800 BC, immediately after claiming that there is no writing for the Olmec. None. Zero. Moreover, Fred Peterson found a cylinder seal, Elatilco, that was reported on by Dave Kelly and that both he and John Graham at Berkeley believed to bear writing. That seal has been dated at Oxford by thermoluminescence at 2,000 to 3,200 years ago. Coming from Tlatco and dating so, it has to be Olmec. It has tentatively been connected stylistically to cylinder seals in Iran of the 3rd millennium by a Near East seals expert who was not told of its Mexican provenance. Regarding population, you said the Aztecs could field fairly good-sized armies, but never in the hundreds of thousands. However, the following facts are documented. The Quiche force opposing the Spaniards numbered 232,000, despite the fact that some groups abstained from the alliance. The Aztecs mustered a force of 400,000 in a fairly routine campaign against a nearby kingdom. More problematic is Alba Isla Xochitl's account of Central American Mexican history, according to which a combined Aztec army at one point consisted of 700,000 men. Of the hazier past, the historian said that in the last War of the Toltecs, which lasted 3 years and 2 months, a total, including women, of 5,600,000 persons were slain. Even if we skeptically and arbitrarily reduce that figure by 90%, the number would be of the same order of magnitude as that reported in the Book of Mormon for the final battle at Cumorah. You also said there are no Semitic words whatsoever in it, meaning Mayan. It's got no relation whatsoever with any languages that we know of in the Old World. However, no archaeologist is qualified to speak in these absolute terms on this abstruse subject. Brian Stubbs, a leading scholar on the Udo-Aztecan language family has shown that languages of that group show major similarities with Hebrew and Egyptian. He concludes that the Udo-Aztecan family developed as a Creole tongue formed from Hebrew, Egyptian, and a native ancestral language of central Mexico that then divided multiple times. Some, but not all, other Mesoamerican tongues show similar characteristics. Meanwhile, a number of other Native American languages have been shown to be connected to Old World sources, few of which had been suspected. Morris Swadesh was among other linguists who feel that it is perfectly possible that a group of people having arrived speaking a new language in the New World eventually were absorbed into an already established linguistic community. The phenomenon he describes would be like what took place with native Toltecs who migrated into Guatemala, where they came to dominate local populations. Linguistic patterns of Highland Guatemala suggest that Toltec influence involved no mass migration of Nahua speakers to the highland. Only small numbers of the Toltecs must have come in contact with a well-established indigenous population, the invader's tongue being absorbed within the linguistic milieu of the more numerous indigenous population. After only about 500 years, Robert Carmack found very little linguistic or cultural, let alone archaeological evidence, for their presence there as their history in the Popol Vuh reported. Yet today, no Mesoamericanist scholar considers the Popol Vuh anything but a fundamental source on the native pre-Spanish culture. The Book of Mormon is in the same situation. Now, about Joseph Smith, John Dillon said, quote, "Joseph Smith himself, you know, would walk around and see a pile of bones and say that the famous Nephite warrior Zelph or whatever, he would see a city and say this was the ancient city of blah, blah, blah," unquote. You did not contradict this. However, this statement is vastly overblown in terms of Smith's real history. He made no such practice. You also said, Joseph Smith claimed that it, the Book of Abraham, was in Reformed Egyptian and that he could read it. But this is factually untrue. Joseph never said the record was in Reformed Egyptian. He said he translated the Abraham record from Egyptian by inspiration, not because he could read it. You claim that Joseph Smith sees the incredible people like the Comanche and the Sioux and Cheyenne and people like that that probably would have influenced him a lot. He had to have horses. But this is patently impossible. Nothing was known in the eastern United States about horse-using Plains Indians in Joseph's day, the 1820s. In any case, the Book of Mormon never suggests that horses were ridden by anybody. On the New World Archaeological Foundation, or the NWAF, you said, they really never found plates of gold or wheels or steel swords or anything of the sort. Constantly arriving there in early days were slight screwballs out of Salt Lake and places like that, coming down with metal detectors, running around trying to find plates of gold and whatnot. But this must be based on gossip or rumor at best. The NWAF's history yields nothing that suggests such an objective was held or that such weird visits ever took place, nor do surviving personnel I know of anything like this. You noted that John Robertson is a fantastically good linguist. It is perhaps of interest that after Robertson retired from the BYU faculty, he and his wife served an LDS mission during which, among other things, they averred the authenticity of the Book of Mormon. Now, regarding the land bridge into Asia, you said that this is something the Book of Mormon archaeologists don't really like to talk about. Why this statement was made is a complete mystery. In the first place, because the frequent expression Book of Mormon archaeologists has no actual reference. Not a single archaeologist I know, or of whom I have heard, does or would call him or herself a Book of Mormon archaeologist. I know of only two who ever did so, Wells Jakeman and Ross Christensen, both of whom have been deceased for quite a while. A few pseudo-archaeologists of a journalistic stripe lurk around the fringes of the Mormon intellectual community, but they are all pretension and no substance. Moreover, there is no reason that archaeologists who are Mormon would hesitate to discuss the Bering Strait route. Book of Mormon archaeologist implies someone trained to a professional level who focuses inordinately on relating that book to the results of archaeology to the exclusion of following professional archaeological goals. Frankly, none exist. Assertions or intimations that NWAF archaeologists have striven to find proof for the Book of Mormon are completely false. Nothing could be further from the truth. Starting with the first season of the NWAF in 1953, even before it had any connection with the LDS Church, the operational guidelines were that the research be conducted according to professional standards without any reference to the Book of Mormon, although the funding was from private LDS donors. Pedro Armias was chosen as the first year's field director upon the advice of Drs. Alfred V. Kidder, Gordon Willey, and Gordon Eckholm, who constituted a professional advisory committee for Tom Ferguson. Gareth Lowe and I were the only archaeological people aboard the first season who were LDS. Other student staff members included Bill Sanders and Roman Pina Chan, both of whom later became premier Mesoamericanists, who could hardly be supposed to be closet Mormons. From the beginning, non-LDS archaeologists working with the NWAF have outnumbered the archaeologists there who were LDS believers. From 1955 on, after Ferguson had appealed to the church for support funds, having exhausted his private funding sources, the eminent J. Alden Mason, an emeritus professor at the University of Pennsylvania who had become editor of NWAF publications and who also assisted with archaeology, supported a judgment from Ed Shook at Carnegie about the NWAF when Mason made a definitive statement on the non-involvement of the LDS Church authorities in planning or reporting the NWAF research. That position never varied from then to the present. With such powerful professional assurances, your own assessment visit to the Chiapas operation was hardly necessary. Moreover, your current intimation that there was a hidden church agenda behind its generous support of the NWAF is both flat-out wrong and prejudicial to any fair discussion of the Foundation's role. You also said, the whole business of Book of Mormon archaeology is to find Zarahemla, to find the plates of gold that were inscribed at the last trump, so to speak. But this deserves to be called nonsense, without the slightest basis in fact. With regard to Near Eastern links, you said, so basically, if you are looking for Old World connections and looking at the Near East, you're looking in the wrong place. You said there are all sorts of things that are typically American, nothing to do with the Middle East at all. There's nothing in the slightest bit Middle East about the Olmec. However, you might plead ignorance of any purely Mormon efforts to demonstrate a relationship between Mesoamerica and the Near East, but how could you not be aware of my 1971 article that discussed this very point? Yet that piece is now superseded by a 2009 paper accessible online. You might well not yet have seen this recent item, since the outlet is relatively obscure. It contains a list, along with extensive references to the literature for each item, of 380 correspondences between cult and ideology aspects of culture between the Near East in the second and first half of the first millennium BC on the one hand, and Mesoamerica on the other. The striking nature and number of the correspondences make it certain that there was a direct diffusionary event that anciently linked the two areas. I choose not to go further with this commentary. It has become rather tedious. My intention has been to inform you about errors in your statements in the podcast. I am sure you would not wish to continue saying what is not factual. Finally, I have a large book in the editing process that deals with these matters in greater depth. The 97-page list of references includes 21 of your writings. When it is in print, I will be pleased to send you a copy. It presents 420 correspondences between the text of the Book of Mormon and Mesoamerican cultural patterns and archaeological sequences. On that basis, I maintain there is no alternative to understanding that the Book of Mormon, Mormon's Codex, could only have originated from the hands of a native Mesoamerican writer, and that scholars will do well to study it seriously, not flippantly.
If you like this podcast, you can help promote it by subscribing to it in iTunes and by rating it and writing a review. Post a link on your blog and Facebook page and tell your friends about us. Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. Music for this episode was provided courtesy of Lawrence Green. The opinions expressed in this podcast are not necessarily the views of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or of FAIR.